Thanks for tuning in to the Next Level Church podcast. If you've never attended in person, we'd love to have you join us on Sunday mornings at 9:30 or 11:05 at 3105 Hampton Highway in Yorktown, Virginia. For more information, check out our website at nextlevelchurch.net.
If you're new to Next Level, I want to welcome you and so honored that you chose to be here today. I want to catch up to speed with something that we do each and every week and ask you to participate with it. It is called YouVersion, and YouVersion is a way for you to connect and get a little bit more out of what you're about to hear. It is a free app that you can download, and the steps are up there on the screen. If you're a regular attender, go ahead and open up YouVersion and to get the most out of this talk. Today, we're concluding our series entitled LML, which stands for Love My Life. That's right. And what we've discovered over the past 6 weeks is that it is up to you to figure out ways to love your life. No one's going to hand you a perfect life on a platter. No one's going to give you everything that you wish you had in life. There are going to be some days that are difficult days. There are going to be some days that are going to stretch you and challenge you, and there are going to be some problems that fall in your lap. But you have to learn how to love your life, because this is the only life that you have. You don't get a redo. There's not a second one at the end. Like, this is it. Your life here on this earth, this is it. You have one shot to learn how to love it. And a little over a week ago, I was out with my wife on a date, and a lot of times we enjoy going to Barnes & Noble for part of our day. It's a free date night, and we check out books. And while we were there, she found a book and brought it to me and said that this book reminds me of our series, LML. And she thought it would be a great way to conclude the series. And after I read it, I couldn't agree more. And so I want to share with you a little portion of a story that's pretty new to me. It is a story of Louis, and it is entitled A Perfectly Messed Up Story. We're going to have a little story time today. It's going to come up on the screen for you so you can follow along. This is Louis's story. That's Louis, everybody. This is Louis's story. Once upon a time, little Louis went skipping merrily along. Tra-la-la-la-la, he sang. For in his heart, Louis knew everything was just, hey, hold on. What's that? Sniff, sniff. Lick, lick. A jelly stain? How did that get there? This isn't right. Who would eat a jelly sandwich while reading my book? Plop. Jelly and peanut butter, the chunky kind. Hey, hey, hey! Somebody's fingerprints are all over this. Oh no, what's next? Orange juice, my story is getting all messed up. We need to show some respect here. Books are important, they teach us stuff, and they inspire us. Now, can I please get on with my story? Thank you. Okay, from the top. Once upon a time, little Louis went skipping merrily along. Tra-la-la-la. La? You have got to be kidding. This is awful. Quick, get a paper towel. Rub, rub, rub. Careful. Careful. Aye. This is the worst thing ever. What am I going to do? Once upon a time, stop, forget it. My story is ruined. It's all over. I'm just in a messy old book that will end up in some garage sale, a book no one will ever want, read, or love. I give up. Go on without me. This is Louis's story. Who cares? Now, this isn't the end of Louis's story. Before we wrap up today, we'll see how it concludes. But up to this point, I don't know about you, but I can relate to little Louis, that I'm walking along in this life, tra-la-la-la-la, enjoying myself, trying to get the most out of it, and then plop, messes happen. And sometimes messes happen because we live in a world filled with broken people, and sometimes broken people bring their messes into our lives, and we experience their brokenness and pain, and we get hurt from it. But there's a lot of times where it's my own brokenness, and it's my own issues and my own problems that bring the mess into my life. Our staff at Next Level Church, I feel like we have a close-knit staff. I feel like we care about each other greatly, and I feel like we get along, not just working together, but we hang out even outside of the church environment. But it would be inauthentic for me to pretend that our staff never has any issues, that we always get along and that everyone is just, you know, always just living in utopia and everything just works out perfectly. There are instances where we get frustrated with one another, and it is difficult, is working with other human beings. It's just tough. And before I became a lead pastor, I didn't realize how tough it was to be the boss. And a couple months ago, I was kind of venting to my wife, Monica, and I was just sharing with her that I didn't realize how difficult it would be. And I said to her that I really did imagine in my brain before I was the boss, I thought once I became the boss, it would be pretty easy, that I would be a pretty good boss. Like, I'm not going to micromanage. I'm going to give a flexible schedule. Like, I've seen how you shouldn't do it, and I've seen how you should do it, and I'm going to take everything I've learned, and I'm going to create an environment where it's just an amazing place where people love to work and everyone gets along. And I told her I didn't realize how much turmoil and sometimes struggle there would be with working with other people. And I shared with her that it must be me, because the common denominator in all the things is me. Like, I'm the only one that is impacting, like, all of this. And I said to my wife that I just never in a million years dreamed that I would be this difficult to work with. And my wife responds with, "Yup." It was not exactly what I was hoping she would say. I was hoping she would say, "Oh no, it's definitely not you. It is them, that you are a great boss." But the truth of the matter is, my wife knows, because I'm a human being and I have flaws and I have messes and I bring junk to the table. There are things in my life that cause problems, and I'm not a perfect person. In fact, if you're here today and you are looking for a perfect pastor or a perfect church, a church without any messes, then please don't leave now, but don't come back next week, because this is a place that is full of mess, that we are a people that have our own issues and have our own struggles, and we are trying with all our heart to love God the way that he loves us, but we just have some issues. And even on my best day, even when I feel like I'm just hitting it out of the park, even when I have my best intentions, I still find a way to kind of mess things up. For example, a few years ago, 4 years to be exact, my wife celebrated her first Mother's Day, and it was about 5 weeks after our twins were born. We have a twin, Reese and Hayden, boy and a girl. And my wife, we had been adamant for a few weeks leading up to Mother's Day that she did not want any gifts on Mother's Day, and she made it very clear that she didn't want anything. And so I went in just thinking that, okay, that's whatever you say, that's what I'm going to do. And so the week of Mother's Day comes, and the guys that I work with asked me, "So what are you going to do for Monica for her very first Mother's Day?" And I said, "Nothing." Like, she told me she doesn't want anything. She was adamant about it. And they said, "No, no, 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 no. You are about to unleash the Kraken. Like, you are going to be in a world of pain if you do not get your wife something." The problem was, at this point, it was way late in the game. It was the end of the week, and I had no money. We hadn't budgeted money for Mother's Day, and I didn't have time to, like, go out and even get something. So I said, okay, I've got to be creative. I've got to do something. And so I started brainstorming what I could do for my wife to do something creative, and I decided to take a couple pictures and to do a blog post. And so I took the following two pictures of my kids while they were sleeping. This is my daughter, Reese, and this is my son, Hayden. And I entitled the blog post "Happy Mustache Day," and the point of the post was that my wife is going to be a great mom, and she loves her kids even though they have mustaches. And I thought it was kind of sweet. I thought it was kind of, you know, nice. And my wife did not complain. She's incredible like that. She didn't give me a hard time. She said she didn't want anything, and she did not give me any grief at all. But when I got to work, they destroyed me. Like, they said, "I can't believe that's all you did. You put Dollar Tree mustaches on your kids, and you took a picture of it. That's all you did." They gave me such grief. They shamed me into wanting to up my game. So the following Mother's Day, I started prepping and planning. The only issue is, once again, I had no money. And I had no money specifically because we had just planted a church. We were just like a few months into planting a church. We had sold our house. We were living with my parents at the time. And we had no money budgeted for a Mother's Day gift. But I was going to come up with something. So I had a plan that I was going to take my phone, which had horrible video quality, but I was going to take my phone and I was going to record a nice video message with my twins wishing my wife Happy Mother's Day. They're 1 year old. They could kind of sort of talk now. And I thought this was a great idea, but even in my best intentions, it was not that great. And I think you'll see why. Check this out.
All right, you ready? Say, "Happy Mother's
Day.
Day. Love you. Mommy. What do you love about mommy?
Yeah. Up.
Do you think mommy's pretty?
No.
No. Do you think mommy's funny?
No.
No. Do you think mommy makes good food?
No.
No? Do you? No. I think the answer is yes. Do you love mommy?
No way.
Yes, yes you do. Do you love her?
No way.
No way. Hey, is mommy the best mommy ever?
No.
Yes.
Way.
Yes way. Say yes way.
What way?
Say I.
So even in my best intentions, I still found a way to mess it up. And thankfully, my wife shows me a lot of grace. But I feel like in almost every area of my life that even when I give my best effort, there is a form of brokenness to it. That there is brokenness shaping almost everything that I do. That there is stuff from my past and stuff about my personality and stuff about my mindset and how I view myself that just brings brokenness into every relationship that I have. And today I want to talk to you about how God can take our brokenness that every single one of us has and he can use it to do something incredible. But the first thing is you've got to admit that you've got a little brokenness to you. And if you're here today and you don't know that you're broken, if you feel that you're perfect, you feel like you're good to go, you're going to get nothing out of what's about to happen. But if you can be a little bit transparent with yourself and if you can acknowledge that all of us have a little bit of brokenness, that there's something inside of us that we get angry too easily and we get offended too easily and we even in our best days, we find a way to mess it up. If you can admit that you have a little bit of brokenness, I think you'll see what God wants to do with your brokenness. Today, our text is going to speak directly to this, and it comes from what we call the Old Testament. Now, if you're new to the church scene, then you may not know how the Bible works, but there are 66 books in the Bible. In your entire Bible, there's 66 books. The majority of them are in what we call the Old Testament. The Old Testament is a story of God. It is a story of God specifically with his people, which we call the Israelites. And it is all throughout there just how God is redeeming them and saving them and forgiving them and working through the children of Israel, the Israelites. Well, that ends, and then there's a 400 years of silence between it. Nothing really happens between the end of what we have the Old Testament and the beginning of what we call the New Testament. After 400 years of silence, Jesus comes onto the scene, and that's what kicks off our New Testament. So the New Testament is the life of Jesus all the way through the early church, and that's how our whole Bible is broken down. Well, if you're not familiar with the Old Testament, then you may miss a lot of the history of really what happened. In the Old Testament, one of the primary key players is a guy by the name of Abraham. And Abraham tells, or God tells Abraham that he's going to create a great nation through him. The problem is Abraham is old as dirt, and his wife is old as dirt. And there's no way this is going to happen. But through amazing miracles and amazing events, God starts producing a large family through Abraham. And they become this entire huge nation that we call the Israelites, or the children of Israel. Well, the Israelites end up in slavery in Egypt. And they are slaves, and this is not where they want to be. And they cry out to God, and God hears their cries, and he sends a messenger by the name of Moses. Well, Moses goes into Egypt, and he tells Pharaoh, "Let my people go." And after a bunch of amazing miracles, finally, Pharaoh says, "You can go." But he chases after him. He follows them into the Red Sea. The Red Sea parts. The Israelites walk through on dry land. It crashes down on Pharaoh's army, and now they're on the other side. Now, if you've ever seen a biblical movie, there's a great chance that you know the story of Moses and the early stages of the Israelites. But what happened to them on the other side of the Red Sea? On the other side of the Red Sea, they were promised that they were going to get this land. It was a land flowing with milk and honey, that it was going to be a promised land for them to set up shop, to have their own place where they could establish and be a lighthouse for the rest of the world to see that they serve the one true God. So they are going and headed to this promised land, but because they are a jacked up, broken up people, they end up messing up, and they have to actually wait 40 years before they enter into the promised land. So for 40 years, they are just waiting around, just wandering in the wilderness. And the vast majority, almost all of the people who were in slavery, pass away and die. A new group rises up, and they get a new leader. It goes from Moses to a guy by the name of Joshua. And Joshua knows that his one big thing in leadership is to take the Israelites into this new land, this promised land. And we're going to pick up learning a little bit about what Joshua does. In Joshua 2, verse 1, you can follow along in YouVersion. Or it'll be up on the screens. It says, "Then Joshua, son of Nun, secretly sent two spies from," that looks like an inappropriate word, but it's not, Go look over the land, he said, especially Jericho. So they went and entered the house of a prostitute named Rahab and stayed there. So this is what's going on. Joshua gets two spies, and he says, hey, this is the promised land that God has given us. The only problem is there's some people already living there. So I'm going to send you out to a specific group of people that are in a city that is surrounded by a giant wall, and the city or the town is called Jericho. I want you to go in there and spy it out, to check on what's going on, who's living there, find out some information. So he sends two young boys, two young spies, and the first thing they do is they go to a prostitute's house named Rahab. Now, as a kid, I just missed this, but as I'm reading this, I'm thinking to myself, I'm not sure that a prostitute's house is the place for two young Jewish boys to go. Like, this just seems a little scandalous, a little sketchy. What are they doing there? And so I started doing some research trying to figure it out, because in all my years hearing of this story, no one has ever said that the spies were jacked up guys, or they messed up, or they forgot their mission. No one ever highlights the fact that two Jewish boys who would have been against their custom to go to a prostitute's house, two Jewish boys went to a prostitute's house. So I started looking at some rabbinical literature, and rabbinical literature is just the teachings of the rabbis. So this isn't stuff that's found in the Bible. It's stuff that rabbis for hundreds of years have taught and passed down to each other. And according to rabbinical literature, the best place for the spies to have gone would have been to go to Rahab's house, because Rahab's house, what they said was she wasn't just a prostitute, but she had a brothel. And they said the best place would be, because the brothel, it would be closer to, in our modern day times, a bar. And if you want to find out information, where is one of the best places for you to go? A bar. People are talking there. People have drank a little bit too much. They're going to give you some secrets. And so the reason these spies are not looked down upon in the Jewish culture is because they went to a smart place. They went to a place to try to gain some information. And so there's nothing in the text that says the spies were shady or they shouldn't have been going to the brothel. They went there to find some information. And that's all we've read so far. Let's keep going. It says the king of Jericho, in verses 2-3, the king of Jericho was told, look, some of the Israelites have come here tonight to spy out the land. So the king of Jericho sent this message to Rahab. Bring out the men who came to you and entered your house, because they have come to spy out the whole land. Now, the only thing we know about these spies is that it's two young spies. And this tells me that they were awful spies, right? Their whole goal as a spy is to go in and not get caught. And we've read like two sentences, and two sentences in, the king has found out that there are spies there that are Israelites. Like, they are awful spies. They're not good at their job. And people start talking at the brothel, at the bar scene, and they start saying, these guys don't belong. And it just brings this picture to my mind that these young spies probably thought they were doing good. They probably thought they were disguised. But it just made me think of, like, I don't know if you ever, like, grew up watching the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles in the 90s, but in the cartoon, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, whenever they would go in public, they would wear this. And I would watch that as a kid and say, that is an awful disguise. Like, you just look like a Ninja Turtle in a trench coat. And that's what I'm envisioning with these two young spies, that they walk into Jericho with a trench coat on, and they're like, you can't tell that we're not from around here. We're fooling everyone. Everyone's like, you're not fooling anyone. We know that you're spies. They get caught. That is the worst thing to happen if you're a spy, to get caught, to get found out. And not only are people talking about it, but they've got word to the king. Now, This is an incredible problem. In fact, this is a bad day. If you're a spy and you've gotten caught within the first few moments of being where you're supposed to be spying out, that's a bad day, right? There's no way to spin this. Like, you have failed miserably. You're a bad spy, and the story is about to be over because you're about to be caught. The thing that I love about what we're about to read, though, is that God takes what is supposed to be a bad story and what's supposed to be an ending and what is supposed to be them being caught, and he turns it into something amazing. And I'm sure in the moment that when the spies heard that the king was sending men to find them out, I'm sure they panicked, and I'm sure they said, I hate my life, and I'm sure they said, this is awful. God, why did you send me here? Why am I in this situation now? But I think that if they would have just held on, if they would have had a positive attitude, if they would have believed that God can take even a mess and turn something great into it, then they would have been able to hold their composure. In fact, I believe that we need to stop looking at the inconveniences of our life as problems and start looking at them as opportunities. The spies had an opportunity. They had an opportunity to freak out and to panic, or they had an opportunity to trust God. God, I'm here. I'm in this situation. I can't change it. They found out. They caught me. And they could either say, woe is me. I hate my life. Or they could say, God, you can use even this mess to bring something great out of it. And what would happen if you and I started looking at the inconveniences of life and started seeing that as opportunities to bring God some fame? What if we looked at our kids, and when our kid has spilled the milk for the 16th time, instead of fussing at them, if we said, this is an opportunity for me to show my kid grace so that one day they can grow up and show someone else grace? What if when our car breaks down, I know it is so inconvenient for your car to break down and it is so awful and you just want to post a picture and say, I hate my life, this is awful. But what if when our car breaks down, instead of seeing it as an inconvenience, we say, maybe this is an opportunity for me to tell someone about Jesus that I would not have met under any other circumstances? What if we started viewing the inconveniences of our life, the problem, I'm sitting in traffic, I don't like traffic. What if this is an opportunity for me to spend some time with God that I wouldn't have got if I would have got to my destination on time? What if we started looking at the problems of life as opportunities to spend some time with God and do something for God? I think it would change our outcome, and I think we'd be able to love our lives. Well, let's keep going with the story to see what happens, because the spies have been found out. Let's see what Rahab the prostitute does. It says, but the woman had taken the two men and hidden them. She said, yes, the men came to me, but I did not know where they had come from. At dusk, when it was time to close the city gate, they left. I don't know which way they went. Go after them quickly. You may catch up with them. Now, Rahab is a prostitute, so there's some shady living. There's some things that are not accustomed to God's, like, chosen people, and she's not one of God's chosen people. She's from a pagan background. She worshiped pagan gods, and so growing up in the church, when I would hear this story, it just always made sense to me that, yeah, she's a liar, too. Like, just go ahead and throw that on her. She's a prostitute, like, and a liar. I did a little bit more research, and none of the texts or the rabbinical literature ever gets mad at her or says that what she did was wrong in lying. In fact, what they view is what she just did is the guys come and say, hey, we know you have spies, and she says, no, yep, they came here, but they left, and so she lied to them. And basically, what the rabbinical culture does is they paint this picture in a very similar way to Nazi Germany. And in Nazi Germany, there were Germans who hid Jews in their houses. And they illegally hid them in attics and basements and behind bookshelves. And they illegally hid them for the good of their life, to spare their life. And none of us would look at that and say, oh, you shouldn't have lied. That was a bad decision, because this was not a selfish lie. This was not a lie to get them out of trouble or try to hide something. This was a lie for the good of humanity. And in the rabbinical culture, this is considered a good thing, that she lied to protect human life. She lied to protect the spies. So let's see what happens. Let's see what happens next. It says, but she had taken them up to the roof and hidden them under the stalks of flax that she had laid out on the roof. So the men set out in pursuit of the spies on the road that leads to the fords of the Jordan. And as soon as the pursuers had gone out, the gate was shut. So this is what happens. Rahab has a flat roof. Culture tells us, history tells us, she has a flat roof. And she had laid a whole bunch of flax, which is kind of like wheat, long like grain, on top of a roof. Now, the reason she did that is it must have been harvest time, and she had done the hard work of collecting all this harvest, and she'd set it on top of her roof to dry it out from the rain, to get it ready to cook, to use in various forms. Now, this seems like so insignificant, and I'm sure while she is sitting there in the field and she is just plowing this flax, that she's saying, this is so annoying. Why do I have to do this? This is such an awful thing to do. And while she's putting it on her roof, she's saying, this is so mundane. I hate this. Why do I have this in my life? And God takes a mundane, a painful chore, and he uses it to hide two of his spies. What if we viewed our life as the inconveniences of our lives as an opportunity for God to do something amazing? And she hides the spies underneath this flax, underneath all the things that she's hiding. And the guys leave because they can't find the spies anywhere, and they run out. And this is what happens next in the story. It says, before the spies lay down for the night, she went up on the roof and said to them, I know that the Lord has given you this land, and that a great fear of you has fallen on us, so that all who live in this country are melting in fear because of you. We have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did at Shihon and Og, the two kings of the Amorites east of the Jordan, whom you completely destroyed. When we heard of it, our hearts melted in fear, and everyone's courage failed because of you, for the Lord your God is God in heaven above and on earth below. I don't know if you're able to capture this or if you're following along with what's happening, but Rahab sends off the men who are searching for the spies, and then she goes up to the roof to talk to the spies, and she says, hey, I know you're tired. I know it's been a stressful day. I know you're about to fall asleep, but before you fall asleep, I just need to tell you, I know who you are. And I know who you are because everybody's talking about you. And everyone is afraid because they've heard about the miracles. They've heard how you walked through the Red Sea. And they've heard how your God has delivered you from Egypt. And everyone else is afraid. But I want you to know, I'm not afraid. I want to join you. Can I become a part of your family? Because I saved you, will you welcome me in? Will you save me? Let's keep reading and see what happens next. It says, I'm actually sorry, I skipped over this. This is incredibly important. This is, according to what we just read in the text, all we know about Rahab is that she is a prostitute. But through the rabbinical literature, it gives us a little bit more insight. This is what rabbis taught about Rahab for centuries. Rahab was 10 years old when the Israelites came out of Egypt, and she pursued her immoral calling during the 40 years that the Israelites were wandering in the wilderness. There was not a prince nor a ruler that had not had relations with her. And she was therefore well informed of what was going on outside of Jericho. I love this insight about Rahab, because if you're thinking that Rahab was a pretty good person, or if Rahab was just, you know, kind of a prostitute, like not really a prostitute, but just kind of, no, she was a full-on prostitute. And the rabbis taught in her day that the reason she had all this information about the Israelites and what God was doing is because she had slept with every prince and every king that had been experiencing what God was doing through the Israelites. So men would come, princes would come, rulers would come, kings would come, generals of armies would come into Jericho, and they had been defeated in battle, and they had been destroyed, and they go into her house, into her hut, they have relationship with her, they have sex with her, and then after that, they're talking about all that they've experienced. They've experienced something incredibly painful that they had lost in battle to this Israelite army, this little just group of ragtag people who is serving this God that is doing amazing things. And through that, Rahab is saying, I'm willing to get rid of all of my pagan lifestyle and get rid of all of my gods and get rid of everything I know and serve you, because I'm hearing such amazing things about what you're doing. So now let's keep reading Joshua 2, 12 through 13. It says, now then, please swear to me by the Lord that you will show kindness to my family because I've shown kindness to you. Give me a sure sign that you will spare the lives of my father and mother, my brothers and sisters, and all who belong to them, and that you will save us from death. So Rahab says, listen, I believe in your God now. Will you save me? I'm used to bartering with people. I'm used to giving them something, and in return, they give me something back. And I just saved your life, and I would really enjoy it. I would appreciate it if you could save my life, if you could save my family's life. And so the spies come up with a plan, and they said, we want you to tie a scarlet red rope outside of your door. And this is going to be a sign to us that we're going to spare your family. And we will spare anyone that's in your house with you. They will be spared. But everyone else is going to go down. So if you're not familiar with the story of Joshua, it is a weird and fantastic and amazing, like it would make an incredible movie. The story of Joshua is what they do is God tells him not to attack Jericho, and that seems so backwards. Like, if you're going to take over something, you should attack it. But he says, no, don't attack it. What I want you to do is I want you to march around Jericho for 6 days. And so literally, they took one lap around Jericho for 6 days and then did nothing, and they just hung out. And for 6 days in a row, they walked around Jericho just one time. On the seventh day, they walked around Jericho 7 times. And on the seventh time, Joshua cued them, and they play their trumpets, they play their horns, they shout. This is the worst plan in the history of plans. Like, if you're going to attack someone, like, attack them. You don't just yell at them and scream at them and play instruments. But God uses this crazy, stupid plan because it was his idea, and he causes the walls of Jericho to tumble down, and the Israelites take over, and the only one that is spared is Rahab and her family, because of what she did. Now, this is the part of the story that I missed. For years growing up, I would hear this story, but watch what happens next. You go just a few chapters to chapter 6, and it says this, but Joshua spared Rahab the prostitute with her family and all who belonged to her because she hid the men Joshua had sent as spies to Jericho, and she lives among the Israelites to this day. So here we have a pagan woman who grew up from the age of 10 to about 50 being a prostitute. And because she hears about the goodness of God, she decides to join the family of God. And she's brought into the family of God, not as a prostitute, as a member of the family of God. And they treat her like a member of the family of God. If that's not already blowing your mind, if that's not already making you think that there's something incredible about our God, that God would take a prostitute and allow him to be a part of his chosen people, then I don't even know how to convey how awesome this is. This is incredible that God would take a prostitute and say, hey, listen, I'm going to welcome you, and we're not going to remind you that you're a prostitute. We're not going to shame you and make you feel bad about your past. You are now one of us. You're going to live among us. You are going to be a part of our people. Even though you grew up worshiping other gods, and even though you have a past that is filled with mess, you are now welcome to be a part of our family. But the story doesn't end there. You've got to fast forward a few thousand years and get to Jesus. And when you get to what we call the New Testament, the very first book in our New Testament is written by a guy by the name of Matthew. And Matthew was a Jew who followed Jesus. He was one of his disciples. And Matthew, when he writes down the story of Jesus, he writes down two Jews from a Jewish perspective. And one of the biggest things in the Jewish world was that when they found the Messiah, he must come from the lineage of King David. Maybe you're familiar with the story of David, David versus Goliath. The Messiah has to come from David. So when we read Matthew, and it starts off with this long list of genealogy, we yawn and we say, this is so boring. What an awful way to start a book. Like, just get into the action. But Matthew was trying to prove that Jesus, the one we're about to read about, is the Messiah. And everything that Matthew put in his book was on purpose and for a purpose. And look what Matthew says at the very beginning of his book, proving that Jesus is from the lineage of David. You can read it with me. It comes up on the screen. It says, Salmon, the father of Boaz, whose mother was, what's that name? Boaz, the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth. Obed, the father of Jesse, and Jesse, the father of King David. So Matthew makes a point. And why in the world does he include a prostitute by the name of Rahab? What he's trying to say to his audience, at least my theory is that he's telling the audience here, hey, I know you're Jewish and I know you have this mindset about who the king is, but I want you to know that this Jesus, he is the Messiah. He is from King David, but he is not the guy that you think he is. He is a Messiah who welcomes prostitutes into his family. There's no reason in the world that a prostitute should be in the lineage of Jesus. And everyone else had this mindset that when the Messiah comes, he's going to be perfect and he's not going to have any issues. And Jesus was perfect and he didn't have the issues. He didn't have the baggage that we did. But Matthew is saying something to us that, look, in the lineage of our Savior, of our Messiah, the one that's going to redeem us, I want you to know that God uses broken people. And God takes broken prostitutes and he welcomes them into the family of God. But not only that, he says, I value you so much, I'm going to allow you to be a part of the lineage of Jesus. We have a God who takes broken people and redeems them and takes broken, messy stories and says, I know you've messed up your story. I know other people have messed up your story. I know there's a lot of junk in your story, but I am the God who takes prostitutes and turns them into family members. Rahab, for her entire life, was used to being given money for her services, and she was only worth whatever someone would pay for her. And now she is worth something incredible because she's not just worth a service that she can give with her body. She is now worth the world because she is welcomed into the family of God. You are only worth what someone will pay for you. But because Jesus paid it all, you are priceless. And if you're here today and you're saying to yourself that you have messed up too much or that your story has too much trouble in it and problems in it, and you've screwed up and you've come to Jesus and you've had a million come to Jesus moments and you've tried to make it right and you keep messing up and over again, you have some struggle. If there is any doubt in your mind that God can ever use a broken person like you, then you need to go back to the story of Rahab, because Rahab is a prostitute from a pagan people who was welcomed into the family of God, and God took a prostitute and turned her into a family member. And God does not see you as a prostitute. And some of you here, your background is a lot like Rahab. If we're honest with ourselves, some of us here, our background is not very clean. Some of us, the reason you came to church was because of your brokenness. It is your fault that the marriage ended. It is your fault that the kids went away. You did some issues. You have some issues. And some of you, the reason you came into church was because you were looking for a little bit of hope, a little bit of redemption. Some of you, maybe you've lived perfect lives. In your lives, there is no mess. There is no dirt. That is awesome. It must be great to be you. I wish I was in your shoes. But for the rest of us, we have some dirt and some baggage and some mess. And some of that is the reason you're sitting in this chair, because you're looking for some type of hope. You're looking for, is there someone out there can still love me despite the fact that I've messed up my own story? And Rahab is screaming at us that we serve a Messiah, a Savior, who redeems messy stories. And Jesus welcomed in Rahab into the family of God, and she became a part of his lineage. I believe that you have a mess of a story that God wants to redeem. And in order to LML, you must embrace your mess and move on to your future. The story of Rahab is not just that she was a prostitute one day and she saved some spies. The story of Rahab is that she saved some spies and she believed in God, and then she became into the family of God. And that means that Rahab didn't walk around acting like a prostitute anymore. And she didn't remind everyone about all her mess and all her baggage. She started actually believing in her heart that she was a part of the family of God. And some of you in here, the switch that needs to flip is that, yes, you have some issues. Yes, you have some ongoing junk. Yes, you have some problems. But you've got to stop thinking like a prostitute, and you've got to start thinking like a family member of God. God can use you. God does want to use you. He wants to heal you. He wants to make you whole, and he has great plans for you. But you've got to stop viewing yourself as woe is me. I've got a messy story, and God can't do anything with me. And you've got to stop acting like a prostitute. You start living for a king. Why? Because that's who you are. You are a daughter of the king. You are a son of the king. No longer are you allowed to act like someone who doesn't know God. You are a part of the family of God. But when you make a mistake, you need to remember that we have a God that takes prostitutes and turns them into family members. We have a God who loves us unconditionally. Don't you dare think that you can out-sin the love and grace of God. That is unfair. God loves you. He loves you. And he wants to use your mess. He wants to save you from the mess. He wants to clean up your mess. He wants to fix you. But in the meantime, you run to him, you serve him, you put your eyes on him and watch what he does. And he takes prostitutes and he turns them in to family members. So I told you that I wanted to finish up a perfectly messed up story about Louis. And I want to read to you how Louis' story ends. It ends like this. Once upon a time, little Louis went skipping merrily along. Tra-la-la-la-la, he sang. Oh, life was so much simpler back then. For in his heart, Louis knew everything was just what? Just what? Fine. Wow. Everything is fine. I'm still here. You're still reading. And it is a pretty good story. Messes and all. So come on. Let's finish this. The end. Maybe the mess that you have in your life is just a chance for God to do something amazing in you. And I don't think that God caused your mess. I think that a lot of us are responsible for our own messes, but we have a God who takes prostitutes and turns them into family members. So when we serve him, we can say, this is a messy story, but it's my story. And God wants to use my mess to transform people. He wants to use my issues to change people. He wants to use my mess to change the world. Would you guys pray with me? God, we're just so honored that we don't get disqualified for being messy, that you take messy people and you make us whole. God, we just ask in Jesus' holy name that, God, you would give us the confidence to work on our stuff, to work on our issues, that we would have the confidence to seek out counseling when we need counseling, and that we would seek out accountability when we need accountability, and that we would seek out help when we need help. God, help us. Help us not to run away from our mess, but to embrace our mess. And God, we just ask that you would do immeasurably more than we could ask or imagine, that you would transform us. Some of us are living Louis stories where we just feel like our life is over because we have some mistakes and some messes, but that's not the end of the story. We get to keep living. So I ask, God, that you would stir something in our hearts, that we would serve you, that we would passionately follow you, and that we would believe that you take prostitutes and turn them into family members. In Jesus' name, amen.
We hope you've enjoyed and learned from today's podcast. If you'd like to connect with us further, you can check out our website, nextlevelchurch.net, or find us on Facebook or Twitter.